you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey folks, I'm Alex Dowd.
And I'm Katie Rife.
Halloween is this weekend, and while plenty of viewers will reach for the reliable classics they put on every spooky season, there's plenty of new horror movies out there to satiate an appetite for fresh scares. In today's episode, Katie and I discuss the year in horror, what was big, what wasn't, and what did the genre proud in 2021.
Welcome to Film Club!
Okay, folks, thanks again for joining us, and happy Halloween.
Yay.
Halloween is still a couple days off for us, or a few days off for us as we're recording this, but if you are listening to this, then you are either, I would say you are either very close to the holiday, or you are, maybe you're listening to it on the holiday as a special Halloween treat.
Passing out candy to trick-or-treaters, you know, lighting a ritual bonfire for, you know, the spirits to come through when the veil gets thin, you know, normal Halloween stuff.
What are you doing this year for Halloween, Katie?
Oh boy, I didn't think I was going to do that much, but it turns out I'm going to do kind of a lot. I might be, the day itself is on Sunday this year, and I have things going on Friday and Saturday, and so I might just be prone on the couch watching a horror movies on Sunday.
The way to go, I think.
I might be a little hungover come Sunday.
Yeah, I'm watching horror movies all day Saturday, so that will be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So last year around this time, we did a whole episode talking about the best horror movies of the year. Sort of looked back at the year in horror and talked about the best ones of this year. Now, just discussing doing that again this year, we kind of realized that this year has not necessarily been a great year for the genre.
Yeah, it feels to me like we're in kind of a transitional period for a couple reasons. One is that there's just sort of this scattershot quality. And I think we're seeing this in all genres of film right now, where you have pandemic era productions mixed in with films that were delayed. And it just makes for kind of a chunky gumbo, so to speak. It makes for a kind of odd mix of projects. And the horror stuff in particular that's coming out, it seems like, I think that horror is in a transitional mode. I think we're coming out of the 2010s emphasis on elevated horror and films about grief and about trauma and really symbolically laden horror movies. And just some stuff that I'm observing anecdotally, I think that we might be moving into an era more like the early 2000s, where it really was just about like loud metal songs and gnarly gore, you know?
Well, I actually, on some level, I sort of hope that you're right. I think that horror goes in cycles. I think we've seen that over the history of the genre, is that we get these little crazes that pop up and they go for a few years and they hardly ever last forever. If you've been reading the website this week, we've been doing this kind of fun thing called the Ultimate Slasher Franchise Tournament.
I had a great time writing
Me
that.
Too.
That
was it was very, very fun to write.
I got to pull out my inner, like, whenever I write something like that that's like deciding who would win, I always just think of the movie Mallrats. I feel like I'm in Mallrats when I do stuff like that.
Yeah. It has been fun. It's on the website now. And you can see that we did a full March Madness style bracket. You can go through the 5 days. Mm-hmm. At this point, if you're listening, if you're listening to this Friday morning, I will say you can still vote on the final, the finals, basically.
Yeah.
The last matchup. But my point was that slasher movies, if you use that kind of as an example, slasher movies had their heyday in the 1980s.
Exactly.
Sort of following Halloween, which we talked about last week on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, the craze kind of died down in the 90s, but then it's come back in various forms. And I feel in horror, nothing ever really dies. It just goes dormant for a while and then comes back.
Yeah. Like, I think that horror, like a lot of things, but maybe especially genre, I don't know, is really driven by nostalgia cycles, I think. And it's really driven by whoever is of the age to be making movies at that particular point, which usually by the time you're directing a movie, you're in your 30s. Not that many people direct a movie in their 20s.
Yeah.
And it's whatever those people watched growing up that kind of, you know, it influences the nostalgia cycle. Like another article we ran on the site for Horrors Week this week was a 24-hour folk horror marathon. And that's a type of film, horror film, that's also been bubbling back up over the past few years. And I was talking with Kayla Janice, who she's a writer and a film programmer, and she's kind of, you know, kind of doing academic work to kind of define this genre and define what it is and all this kind of stuff. And she was talking about how there's a couple different things going on with the rise of folk horror that I think applies to horror more broadly. Number one, she said that a lot of people who grew up in the 70s when movies like The Wicker Man were big, when you think of folk horror, think The Wicker Man. That's like the classic example of that type of movie. And then those people are making movies now. So that's just like the practical answer as to why mm-hmm. that type of movie is coming
or
back.
Or their children are making movies, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, people who were children when they saw this stuff
are
now making movies.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think about that a lot with music too, honestly, when you see revivals of – I'm a heavy metal fan,
mm-hmm.
and it's been interesting over the last few years to see there's this crop of hardcore bands that are very clearly influenced by nu metal.
Oh, dude, the return of like 2000s emo is going to just crush my soul. Like, I'm just like, oh, man.
Yeah. So, it always goes in cycles. And I think nostalgia is probably part of it. And when these filmmakers grew up is part of it. I also think it just speaks to how carnivorous the film industry is and how cannibalistic it is.
Mm.
And how if there's ever – horror – it's interesting with horror because no matter how classy the first film like a horror movie is, if it's a big hit, they will try to beat it into the ground, you know?
Absolutely.
Like, you can get a first entry in a series that is just so classy, you will sometimes get a shitty sequel or several to that because somebody is like, we can make more money off.
Are you saying we're lucky we dodged the Babadook franchise? That we could have been a Babadook franchise?
Well, I was thinking about It Follows. I was like, I was a little bit surprised that we didn't see an It Follows sequel.
It is odd that none of these, you know, quote unquote elevated movies that are big in the past, five, six, 7 years. Like, we haven't seen a lot of sequels of those. Why aren't we on It Follows 4?
I think that it has to do with the fact that those movies are ultimately art house hits, and the amount of money that they made is reflective of that.
Mm.
Like The Witch is a great example. The Witch is sort of the definition, I would say, of a modern art house horror movie.
Yeah, and I think it's a great movie. I will defend that movie all day long.
I have issues with it, but it's certainly a really strong piece of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. There's no question mm-hmm. there. And I think highly influential in terms of the last few years of horror.
Absolutely.
But, you know, in The Witch did okay in theaters because they opened it because A24 just said, fuck it, and opened it wide.
Right.
So it was in multiplexes. But audiences hated The Witch.
Yeah.
You know, it made that kind of money because it was a wide-release horror movie that was available in multiplexes all over the country. There was no sense from audience reaction to The Witch that people wanted more of it. And I think that's kind of the same deal with something like It Follows, as acclaimed as that movie is. I don't think general audiences were like over the moon for it. I think it just made money because it was out there and available to see in multiplexes.
Yeah. I could see that. And it is notable that since then they've kind of dialed back that approach. Even A24, you know, when we talk about, you know, when the history books record the 2010s in horror, A24 is going to come up a lot.
Yeah.
Because it was really a driving force over the past few years to the extent where people use it as an adjective to describe a certain type of movie. Like if you say, oh, well, it's an A24 movie, you don't even necessarily mean that it's being distributed by that company. You just mean that it has like great cinematography, it's super slow, it's symbolically loaded, and it may or may not actually be scary.
Yeah, I do think that people sometimes exaggerate the extent to which all A24 movies are interchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the reasons that you've seen that is that there's been some confusion out there with some neon titles that people are just assuming that people are mistaking for A24 movies.
I mean, I think that there's a difference between Neon and A24 movies, but like it's my job to pay attention. So, mm-hmm. you know, obviously.
I guess my point ultimately is that A24 has branded itself very well.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's
Dude,
why
how
people...
much do they charge for like those fleeces and candles and stuff? They've got merch now.
Too much. Yeah. I mean, the idea, it's very funny to me, the idea that there are now like people simping for a distributor.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
you know, you'll see like on Twitter people being like, what's your favorite, what are your five favorite A24 characters? And it's just like,
that's what I mean.
Guys,
it's an adjective. It's a yeah. subgenre unto itself now.
Yeah. And I think that they do very much, A24 is looking for a certain kind of movie to pick up and sometimes to fund. But I think the notion that you can somehow draw a straight line through all of their output, even their horror movies, I think is a little overstated.
No, it is overstated because there are films in that style that are not distributed by A24 as well.
Right.
Like think of like Relic, which came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
That could have, you know, it was in that same style, but
right.
they didn't distribute it.
Or The Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
The Lodge is very, if you want to talk about A24 horror,
mm-hmm.
The Lodge is so
Who distributed bad. That one? Neon?
Yeah, Neon.
So there you go. There's the confusion.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Neon has over the past few years kind of they're kind of positioning themselves as a competitor for A24
Absolutely.
In a particular kind of movie that they're picking up.
It is interesting that these relatively new companies have positioned themselves to where, like, I think that they have more power kind of in the horror, at least in, like, the festival space, than really long-running distributors like IFC Midnight or Magnet Releasing. Like, they have an advantage over – because IFC Midnight's been just, you know, churning out horror movies for what, at least 20 years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, IFC in general as a company, obviously they release – occasionally they release great films. But that is really like – feels like a clearinghouse sometimes where they're just like how much we just release things in bulk. This is a total side note. But the other day I was trying to figure out what was the smallest company that had released a Best Picture nominee ever.
Mm-hmm.
So pointless way to procrastinate on something else I should have been doing, I'm sure. But I think what I came up with was IFC, which IFC released Boyhood a few years ago. And I don't know if this is true in terms of the actual amount of money they're dealing with, but I feel like IFC is a quote-unquote smaller company than, say, A24 or Neon.
At this point, because, yeah. you know, like when Moonlight came out, A24 was brand new.
Right. Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So at that time when Moonlight did win, the answer would have been A24. But now.
Yeah.
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 But anyway, so like that's kind of the nitty gritty nuts and bolts of the business and the way that the business has worked the past few mm-hmm. years. And you also have something that I've noticed over the past few years on that note real quick. Like there's been the rise of some other names that you see all over stuff. Like there's Dark Star Pictures has kind of risen the past few years. Mm-hmm. RLJE Films. You want to talk about a clearinghouse. And then Shudder. Shudder mm-hmm. Has emerged in the past decade. And it is they pick up tons of movies now. They have they might be reaching they might be having the Netflix problem where they're putting out too much.
I think they want to be the Netflix for horror fans, you know. And actually, I think that their selection is kind of in some ways is akin to Netflix, although they do have a lot of revered classics on there as well.
Yeah, yeah. And even in the originals, they put out some really good originals. Like mm-hmm. later, I'm going to talk about a Shudder original, but like they just put out so much.
Trying to corner the market, really.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. That like it's the same problem that Netflix has where things kind of get lost in the flood sometimes.
Yeah. You discussed earlier how you felt like we're in this weird transitional mm-hmm. space, and I think a lot of that has to do with it's not just about trends in filmmaking, it's also about trends in distribution and about where we are in terms of how a movie is being released.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the reasons that it's so hard to track exactly what the state of a genre is that it's been so spread among these different platforms, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we do still have theatrical movies, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that still exists and movies are still coming to theaters. But there is now a whole market of films that are made specifically for streaming or that pop up on the festival circuit and then show up on streaming.
Yeah.
And I think that the whole game has changed in a lot of ways, I think.
And on the festival circuit, too, I mean, the number of genre-specific festivals that exist has – since I started like covering that regularly when I started here in 2015
mm-hmm. –
And that's proliferated immensely, just the number of festivals for horror movies to play and the number of distributors that will pick them up and all that kind of stuff. Like, as an industry, it's gotten so big that, and because of, like you were saying, the sort of platform shift, maybe it's inevitable that things – it's hard to pick out what the standout titles are, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if we had done – if we did this exercise in the past and we wanted to say what was the what was the most prominent horror movie of the year?
Mm.
I feel like in past years, we could probably do that a little bit more easily. I mean, if you look back at like a year like 2019, a couple of years ago before the pandemic, I feel like you could say it was Midsommar maybe.
Right.
It was maybe Us, the Jordan Peele film.
And you can go back to like 2018. The biggest one was the first David Gordon Green Halloween. Go back 2017. Mm. It was Get Out. Like, you can pick out a biggest film of the year in that regard.
It's trickier this year, though, because, I mean, there is I think we've seen a variety of things. Obviously, we've seen indie horror films this year. Mm-hmm. We've also seen big Hollywood movies. But I don't think any of the – correct me if I'm wrong, but I really don't feel like any of the big Hollywood, particularly the big Hollywood franchise horror movies, were really sensations this year.
No, not really. The most successful one, you know, if you want to go by the good old money metric, Halloween Kills is doing really well. Candyman performed strongly at the box office, as I recall. So did Quiet Place 2. But yeah, none of them. I think it might just be a issue of cultural saturation. You know, the lack of a monoculture, like the.
Yeah.
Everything that people have been talking about since the rise of streaming and the internet, and if you're not familiar with the term, monoculture means, like, for example, when there were three TV channels, everybody watched the same TV shows, that's a monoculture. When most everyone within a particular culture is familiar with some sort of cultural artifact, because there just aren't that many, you know?
Yeah. But now it's spread so thin in a lot of ways. It's spread across so many different places. And and the pandemic, I think, exacerbated that in a lot of ways, because, you know, I mean, as recently as a couple years ago, I still remember feeling like we could look at a new theatrical release as this tentpole of the week, this thing that everybody was going to be talking about, this water cooler thing. And I think partially because of the pandemic, but partially because of things that have been going on for longer than the pandemic.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I think we're getting to a place where the notion of there being this one thing that everyone is talking about is kind of going the way of the dinosaur, you know?
Yeah, even within these subcultures, you know, there is another interesting rise in the past decade is that there is a defined horror subculture, like as a lifestyle, like punk or metal, and it's very tied to punk and metal. But even within that subculture, not everybody is necessarily talking about the same thing, unless it's a big thing like Halloween Kills or Candyman, unless it's a big hit.
Right. But I mean, how much life do those things even have beyond their first week even, you know?
2 weeks maybe if it's a really big one.
I felt like people were over Candyman by the following week, you know? I mean, I'll say our perspective on this is skewed too, because we sometimes are seeing these things a little bit earlier than other people. So by the time a movie hits theaters or a streaming platform, sometimes you and I are like, that's coming out this week, isn't it?
Can I just give a little side note of a little behind the curtain thing real quick? It's Halloween week and everyone is planning ahead for, you know, like Thanksgiving and Christmas right now. And I'm like slightly miffed. I understand that we work ahead, but I'm like, guys, it's Halloween week. Why are we talking about this?
Like, can we please just stay in the moment? Halloween is the best holiday in my opinion.
It's my favorite.
Yeah.
It's always been. When I was a little kid, it was my favorite when I was a little kid.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of box office, I think that the one that you have to probably the big hit of the year in the horror sphere is A Quiet Place 2.
Mm.
Looking at the numbers, it was indeed A Quiet Place 2. And but honestly, I think that has less to do with some sort of – I don't think A Quiet Place – as big of a hit as the first Quiet Place was, and as excited as people were for a sequel – I don't think A Quiet Place 2 was some sort of cultural event, really. I think what it came down to was that it arrived at the perfect time to be a big hit, because it came at the end of May when people were very much itching to go back to
the movies. When vaccinations were kicking in.
You know, I remember I was vaccinated by the end of – fully vaccinated by the end of May, and I think a lot of people were – including a lot of people who are in the demographics that go to the movies a lot traditionally.
Mm-hmm.
So I think A Quiet Place was just the big movie that everyone felt like they could safely go see.
Mm.
And, you know, it was the first movie of the year to cross 100 million at the box office, which is something that had not happened since, you know, early 2020.
Right.
So, you know, as much as I think if you wanted to look at the year from purely a box office perspective, you'd have to say the big horror movie of the year is A Quiet Place Part Two.
Mm.
I don't know how much of a tail this thing has in terms of people wanting to talk further about it, in terms of this becoming a
It didn't last up to Halloween, I'll say that much. It hasn't really been discussed much. But there is something that I was thinking about recently in terms of – I was thinking about the new Halloween movies and how they really go out of their way to try to imbue them with this greater meaning beyond just Michael Myers killing people and you cheering like, yay, that was cool. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about it in terms of monoculture. And I was wondering if, like, maybe – so, like, these big recognizable IPs, and something like Michael Myers is an IP. Halloween's an IP. It's a recognizable brand. I was thinking about them as kind of sites for people coming together as a culture, because you don't really have very many places left where a culture can come together to kind of process its feelings about things.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's why things like Halloween Kills, people want to attach so much importance to them and so much like meaning to them.
It could be it as just sort of a lightning rod in which people can, gather around.
Just a site of coming together as a culture, you know. To kind of shift the conversation a little bit, something that I think horror really reflects, and movies all reflect, but I think because they really deal with like subconscious fears and anxieties, horror movies reflect them especially, throw them into the sharpest relief. Sorry, I can't talk right now. So this is another thing that came up in when I was interviewing Kayla about folk horror. She said that she thinks that a reason why because like witchcraft and astrology and crystals and herbs and all that kind of stuff has become very popular in the past 5 years. I wrote an article about this for the website a few years back. And she thinks that it comes from just like increasing instability in society and people being dissatisfied with, you know, like the modern way of life.
Sure.
And so people are turning back to pre-modern modes of living. They're like searching for something that means more than just going to your corporate job every day and then buying stuff.
Sure.
So anyway, I think that maybe this style of horror that's been really popular has sort of corresponded to this cultural moment. And in the past couple years, we've had a different cultural moment starting to emerge, which is this hateful MAGA subculture culminating in the January 6th coup attempt. And something that I've noticed, a few films I saw at fall festivals, I think are kind of channeling that not the sadness that we've seen being processed in, you know, the quote unquote A24 films. This is like rage and confusion.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these films are like hitting some people the wrong way because they are kind of co-opting like the language of online conspiracy theory and just angry white men on the internet, white supremacists, you know, all that kind of stuff is really scary. And so there's three horror films that I saw this fall that kind of channel that and and people were very angry at these films when they screened. And I think that it's all related in a larger political way when you want to talk about like the turning of the cycles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's The Sadness, which we talked about on the show, Dash Cam, which we talked about on the show, and a movie called The Scary of 61st that I saw last weekend.
What is that one?
So that movie was made by a woman called Dasha Nekrasova. I have not listened to her podcast, but I guess she's one of those quote unquote dirtbag left people who really revels in, you know, being offensive and doesn't believe in wokeness and political correctness and blah, 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 blah. I don't even want to get into all that nonsense. But she made a horror movie about these two women who move into an apartment in New York and they're getting a suspiciously good deal. And it turns out that the apartment was used to house sex trafficking victims of Jeffrey Epstein.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it's like a very gleefully offensive movie. She like really plays with conspiracy theories and stuff in it. And that's sort of and I think that is tied to this larger it's a reflection of sort of the chaos and anger of the past couple years that I'm seeing reflected in these movies. And it's interesting because a lot of the audience doesn't seem to like them very much.
I mean, maybe the type of stuff it's reflecting is something that has been in our fucking faces every day. Constantly. So the idea of seeing it on a movie screen might not be that appealing to some
people. Yeah, you don't want to see a fictional version of the same crap you've been through in real life forever.
I think there's something interesting there, though, which is that I think that horror's relationship with what's going on in the cultural zeitgeist and what mm-hmm. we're all feeling, our anxieties that are out there in the air, is something that's very real. But I think it comes from two different places. I think there are horror movies that simply reflect the mood of the period in a subconscious mm-hmm. way, I think, mm-hmm. where the filmmakers aren't necessarily looking to consciously tap into that. They're just grabbing onto something that's in the air, maybe something that's just in their own hearts or mm-hmm. their own feelings, but they're tapping into something in a less direct and less conscious way. And I think you'll see that in a lot of horror movies that just sort of maybe sort of feel like accidental zeitgeist films.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think there are tons of horror movies. Horror, I think, in general, as a genre, as a commercial genre,
mm-hmm.
you know, people talk about these as exploitation movies. I think that one of the things they exploit is what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
So some of them, I think, are very direct about being like, what's something that we can kind of crassly riff on here?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right, because at its core, I'm going to get slightly pedantic. And, you know, an exploitation movie, it's, you know, quote unquote, exploitable elements.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be all kinds of things. It can be that you have a down on their luck movie star in the movie. Mm. It can be, like you said, current events. Like in the early 70s, you had a wave of exploitation movies that were inspired by the Manson murders.
Right.
You know, anything that's going on in the culture, you'll see it reflected in these type of films about a year later. And yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing January 6th in some horror films.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting, too, with horror because a lot of genres, you know, I mean, if we're looking at what Hollywood is mostly making these days, Hollywood is investing largely in giant productions that take enormous number of people to make, and they take sometimes years to put together. Something like, you know, like Dune that's out right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's a movie that's years in the making.
Mm-hmm.
Horror, in general, tends to be a little cheaper, a little easier to make.
Quicker.
So I think sometimes the reason that you see horror movies feel reactive in a way that other genres sometimes don't is that people churn them out.
Yeah.
You know, is that somebody says, do we have the resources to make a horror movie? Yes, we can have that. We can have that done. I mean, look at something like last year's Host, which I still haven't seen. I need to watch this movie. But I feel like if there was a movie of last year, a horror movie of last year that everybody kind of agreed that was the 2020 horror movie, it was probably Host, right?
Yeah, that was the one I recommended last year. Mm-hmm.
And that was made in weeks, you know? And that was made during the pandemic. And that came out, I feel like that was on Shudder by June or something.
Yes, it was. And everyone went, oh, God. But then the movie turned out to be pretty good.
Right. So. I need to see this film, to be honest. Maybe I'll watch that this weekend.
Speaking of fast turnaround, the same guy who made Host made this dash cam movie.
Right, exactly.
Which played at Toronto in September.
Right.
So in less than a year, he had a new movie out.
Rob Savage is
his
name, right?
Yeah, he's British, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely a guy who is acutely aware of the opportunity he has to tap into what's going on right now.
Yeah, he's working in the exploitation mold for sure, for sure. But what's interesting, you know, we're talking about reflecting the current moment, but at the same time, this is such a strange year. It's such an odd mix because there's also movies that have been held that were supposed to be out a year ago.
That's true.
So, and when you're talking about the kind of current event aspects of horror, it can get a little stale if you hold it for a year and a half.
Yeah. Well, but even like Halloween Kills, that's kind of accidentally that's both intentionally and accidentally relevant because I think that if you haven't seen Halloween Kills, there's an element of sort of mob mentality in it. That's a big thing. It's very preachy, actually, about who's the real monster here and about mob mentality. And, you know, obviously when they were making the film, they were probably tapping into a general kind of mob hysteria that's going on in America over the last few years.
Those rumblings were there before.
Exactly.
January 6th.
But it becomes sort of accidentally reflective of a specific moment too.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
that suddenly this movie that was made to sort of capture the general sense of where our culture's at, this sort of indiscriminate rage and hostility and blaming and scapegoating, suddenly that also has a specific moment art is sort of accidentally imitating life.
Yeah, no, way, and another movie that I felt this way about, I even wrote an FOC about it for the site, was the new Conjuring movie, The Devil Made Me Do It. You know, you have this rise of a new satanic panic going on with QAnon and with all that kind of rhetoric online. And that movie ended up becoming accidentally timely in the same way, where it was about a satanic panic murder that happened in the 80s. But then by the time the movie came out, we were in the upswing of a new satanic panic. Yep.
Which also suggests, I think, if we're just tracing that line of thought, that it's not just cycles. The cycles that we're talking about here are not just cycles of movie making and of trends in movies, but cultural cycles,
yes,
too.
Yes, absolutely cultural cycles as well. Yeah, they all tie in together.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about some of the trends in horror movies this year. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've already talked a little bit about, although I will say, you sort of suggested that we might be moving out of the A24 style into something new. Or just
movies about, like, to put it very flippantly, movies where they're like, it's really about grief.
But we still got those this year.
Yes, we did. You know? But it's not over. It's just petering out.
Yeah. I mean, that might be wishful thinking.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
I don't know. Which is interesting because...
We'll revisit that statement in a year, right?
And we don't need to relitigate the whole elevated horror thing. We did a whole episode on it last year. If you want to hear us talk about that trend... and some of our feelings about it, you can jump into that. All I will say is that it's been interesting, my own feelings about this, because I've generally have liked a lot of the films that sort of inspired people to start talking about elevated horror. Mm-hmm. I loved It Follows. I think it's one of the great horror movies of the last 10 years. I like The Babadook a lot. I liked The Witch. Mm-hmm. These are films I enjoyed, but it has been calcifying into a shtick, kind of.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, sometimes kind of a reason, like, movies that don't go that hard in terms of, like, trying to create a visceral experience, you know, they just kind of let atmosphere carry the day.
Oh, yeah, they just totally lean. And it's always the same kind of atmosphere, too. It's this sort of groaning dread, these sort of strings that are going, and we have these long, woozy shots, and the camera is creeping very slowly around spaces. And again, I like that
stuff. I like
stuff.
A lot of those
I
movies,
like that
man.
Stuff.
I
but
even it, liked It Comes at Night, which I know a lot of people hate.
I don't like that one.
It's okay.
I think what it comes down to is that as with any other thing, techniques that seem exciting at first through repetition can get boring, can get predictable.
Absolutely, 100%. It's just sheer repetition.
Yeah. Right? And I think it's interesting that from what I hear, and again, this we haven't seen the movies yet, but the two filmmakers who have been most closely associated with this particular movement, Ari Aster and Robert Eggers, both seem to be talking about their next movie being a departure from it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They're like, okay, we came, we saw, we conquered, we're moving on.
Yeah, as it should be.
Yeah, yeah. You know, do something else in your career, I guess.
Yeah. Look at Wes Craven. He didn't do the same thing over and over and over again.
Exactly. One of the things that always struck me as just a brief detour into Wes Craven. One of the things that always struck me as kind of sad is that a few times throughout his career, Craven discussed the fact that he never actually really wanted to just be a horror guy.
Yeah.
It was something he didn't want to get stuck in that box. And he did, basically. He made, as far as I know, he made one film in his entire career. It's I might be forgetting something.
Songs from the Heart.
Music from the Heart,
Music
I think
from
it's
the
called.
Heart, yeah.
Yeah, the Meryl Streep film.
Yep.
That's the only film, I think, in his whole career that doesn't qualify at least as a thriller.
Right.
And it makes me a little sad that Craven didn't, on some level, just get to make other kinds of movies.
Okay, an even further departure, but a really interesting case study in that is Vampire in Brooklyn, where you had Wes Craven, who didn't always want to do horror, and Eddie Murphy, who didn't always want to do comedy. And they both
both
got pushed into doing the thing that they were sick of doing. And I think it kind of shows in the
that's
movie.
That's interesting, really?
Yeah.
Like, Craven, ultimately, it did become a horror movie, but also Eddie Murphy's sort of doing comedy in it too, right?
Yeah, well, Eddie Murphy wanted it to be straight horror, and Wes Craven didn't really want to do a straight horror movie.
Right.
And so, like, yeah, you just a lot of wires got
That's
crossed
fascinating.
On that film. Yeah.
Yeah. In any case, so what other trends have we seen this year in horror?
Well, I think, witches were the big thing for a while, but I think vampires have overtaken witches.
They always come back, the vampire.
Yes, they do.
That's one horror movie genre that will always revive itself. Mm-hmm. And it just that's one that like I feel like once a decade at least we get a vampire revival.
Oh yeah.
You know?
I mean it's like they're cool. You know, it's just a cool sexy genre. And I think it kind of ties into another trend I see going on right now, which is queer horror. Mm-hmm. I think that the vampire is, it's obviously a very sexually loaded symbol, but it can also be a queer symbol, you know?
Yeah.
Because, and I think that that particular strain of, there's been a lot of acknowledgement of the queer subtext that already existed in horror movies and all these characters that have already existed the whole time. And you've also seen creators like, for example, Don Mancini, who created Child's Play. Mm-hmm. He didn't always at first really he wasn't always really out and proud necessarily in his filmmaking, but in more his more recent projects he has leaned more heavily into his identity as a gay man, as a gay person, and embracing camp in his movies and all that kind of stuff. And there's a Chucky TV series that's on right now that leans into that sort of queer mm-hmm. angle of the whole thing. And
that has to be partially a product too of just the way that the culture has changed too, right?
Yeah right. That is part of a horror being reflective of the larger culture. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Where there was a time where being gay in Hollywood was something that you did not want to be a known thing,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
and that you were what many people would hide, and now it's something that people a part of people's identity that they can actually explore in their work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you see it reflected in there's been not a huge one, but I think you've seen sort of a revival of teen slashers is happening at this particular moment.
Very much so.
In the Fear Street trilogy, you see the conflation of the revival of the teen slasher and you know, the emergence of queer horror that comes together in the Fear Street trilogy. And then I haven't seen it yet, but there's a more recent Netflix teen slasher called There's Someone Inside Your House.
Right, from Patrick Bryce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet either. But my understanding is that one is a bit of a nostalgia piece too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting, on the side, I do a little bit of programming of horror movies along with my job as a critic. And we do all repertory. It's just cleaner and easier, like if you're a critic, to not be programming newer movies. It gets very messy with conflicts of interest very quickly that way. But
yeah.
We're mostly doing older films. And I really like observing the trends. And I will say, based on my anecdotal observations of movie-going habits in Chicago, 70s horror is out. 90s and 2000s, early 2000s horror is in. House of Wax, in.
That movie is so much fun. I actually just recently rewatched that myself. It's by the French filmmaker Jean-Colette Serra, who has since sort of carved out a whole niche for himself making Liam Neeson vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
But early in his career, he made a couple of horror films. He made the House of Wax remake, and he made the delightfully nasty Orphan,
mm-hmm.
which is just such a mean-spirited movie in a way that I really enjoy. But House of Wax is a fun like new metal era slasher movie.
Yeah. Like the new metal era of horror, I think, is kind of bubbling back up. Get ready.
Where like El Nino and stuff would show up in the end credits.
Oh, you know? Dude.
Like Freddy versus Jason is very new metal.
Oh, yes, 100%. Although I think the most new metal horror movie of them all is Queen of the Damned.
Oh, yeah. Well, it has a whole new metal soundtrack.
Yeah. The guy from Korn did original songs for the movie.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep. No, trust me. I remember.
Yeah. So your time is coming, Dowd. It's almost here.
can't wait to get
it's coming for you like the demon cam in Evil Dead. It's zooming straight at you. The new metal revival.
That's like my Pennywise. I'm being pulled back into the new metal world.
Oh boy. Every 20 years.
The old Limp Bizkit t-shirt comes out of the drawer. Something. I don't know. It's very embarrassing.
No, I love it. Whatever, man. But yeah, it's interesting, you know, those cycles going through. And the Scream movies are really popular amongst like younger viewers now. You want to talk about stuff that people are discovering and the element of nostalgia. Yeah, it's sort of like the Scream movies and new metal horror, as we called it at Music Box, I think are kind of the way things are going.
I think what's interesting is that this is probably something that's kind of always happened, at least depending on access, at least since the VHS era, where younger people who had never seen these things could get their hands on them.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly there was this renewed interest in these horror movies of the past.
Absolutely.
You know? But I think what we see now, because of the internet and because of platforms like TikTok and Twitter, you basically get these trends, kind of these revival trends.
Mm-hmm.
Spread a little bit more quickly, I think.
Oh, very quickly. You know? Like, I guess the mountain goats is the hottest thing on TikTok right
now. That's so bizarre to me.
Yeah, whatever. Got good taste, I suppose. I like the mountain goats.
Oh, sure, of course. That's just so bizarre. It's so bizarre to see a younger generation just suddenly embrace something from... I think it's something that happens all the time. I just think that it's so much more visible now because there are literally platforms where people are hashtagging these things.
Yes, you know? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Oh, trust me. I have, you know, I thought when the 80s came back that was like, oh, I'm so old. But like, no, it's the 2000s coming back where I'm like, oh, my God, I'm not young anymore.
Yeah. It's like hearing... It's like hearing Green Day on classic rock radio.
Oh, yeah.
Now.
You know, like, people referring to stuff from the 90s as an old movie. I want to strangle them.
Dig my fucking grave, you know, just turning to dust like at the end of the third Indiana Jones movie or something.
Yeah.
I feel like when somebody calls Jurassic Park an old movie, I just wither away into dust immediately.
Sorry, the cold hand of death gripped me so hard. I smacked the microphone there. Sorry, everybody. But, you know, we had, speaking of the 2000s coming back around, we had a new Saw movie this year.
We did.
Yeah.
We did have a new Saw movie. And you want to talk about a movie that is at least, I'm going to confess something up front here. I have seen exactly one movie in the Saw series, and that is Saw 1.
Okay.
Which I saw in theaters. One of the first movies I saw in Chicago, in fact, because I just moved to Chicago in the fall of 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not get anybody to go with me to see Saw. So I went alone to Webster's place.
I think going to movies alone is one of life's great pleasures.
It is fun.
But it's nice. I'm a lone wolf type of person in general. So.
In any case, though, it's my understanding that the new Saw, it makes a very explicit attempt to be about something that's going on right now.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
It's about policing in America.
Yeah, they work in a lot of commentary about police brutality. And it's also another thing that's kind of been happening over these past few years where it is a horror project driven by a comedian. Because it was Chris Rock who was the driving force behind getting the new Saw, Spiral, the Book of Saw, it's called, made.
Right. And then, that's a trend that extends to Jordan Peele's career, obviously, you know? I mean, he started, obviously, had a whole career in comedy, and then he made Get Out and Us, and he co-wrote this year's Candyman as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Danny McBride co-writing Halloween Kills.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, comedians are kind of moving into that that area.
Mm-hmm. I think in terms of Hollywood horror, the one that I've... And there's a couple I've liked, but I think one of the ones that I've liked most this year was the new M. Night Shyamalan movie, Old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the more original Hollywood films to come out this year. And Shyamalan cultural cycles, he's come back around from darling to pariah to darling again.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, this one got divisive reviews. But I thought it was quite effective. We actually have a whole episode on Old if you want to hear it. I got to go back to the archives to this summer. You can hear us talk more about Old. But you're right that part. I think one of the reasons this is a sad reality of this job is that there's so much IP that we're dealing with at all times. To just see something that feels like a semi-original vision, obviously Old is based on a French comic book, so technically it is IP. But it's not a franchise movie. Almost every other Hollywood horror movie this year was a part two or a part three or a reboot.
Right. It's not IP in the sense of like familiar names and characters are what's driving the film.
Exactly. Yeah. It's an adaptation, but that's it, honestly. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Old showed me things that you don't see in a horror movie all the time, you know, and tapped into some – You know, we've talked so much in this episode about horror movies that are trying to be about timely anxieties.
Mm-hmm.
Old, I felt like, tapped into a universal timeless anxiety.
Yeah,
we are
really
all getting old.
Thing. Yeah,
exactly. We all get old. Our bodies fall apart, and our children will one day get old and die as well.
Yeah, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. There's actually some really unsettling scenes in that movie. It's got the Shyamalan clumsiness in some of the writing, but there are some really effective, unsettling moments in that movie.
Mm-hmm. And another movie that this wasn't a Hollywood movie. It played at Sundance. It's a British movie, which I think it had some BFI backing. It was pretty mainstream. It was a British film. And I didn't think this was a perfect film by any means, but, you know, looking back over the year, one that I thought made a stamp in terms of being original and memorable was Censor.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Censor premiered at Sundance. I think we talked about it in the Sundance episode, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah,
but that was back in January. Oh, my goodness.
It was quite some time ago. I agree that that's an interesting film. I didn't think it quite worked, to be honest. But I think that it is a movie with some ideas. And the ending of that film has stuck with me over the year.
Yeah, yeah.
Very strong ending.
And just a lot of the imagery from the film, you know, the way that it kind of transitions from like 80s period piece into sort of phantasmagoria nightmare world was pretty cool. Just the way that the two worlds crept up on each other, I thought was pretty neat.
For sure.
But in terms of like, you know, covering all the horror fests and stuff, really, there weren't that many standout titles for me this year.
Yeah.
I mean, The Sadness stuck out, obviously, just because it's a memorable movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, like, I thought that this year was a lot of stuff that was pretty good, but not that much that was really blowing me away, I suppose.
Now, I caught up with something very recently that I'd love to talk about briefly.
Yeah.
And it's one that I know that you liked and also one that I think you could make the case that it's not a horror movie, even if it's playing with horror trends. But I'll stop beating around the bush. the film is Violation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's interesting because I've been wanting to see this for a while. I've just been wanting to get around to it. I've also felt a little nervous about watching it, just hearing about how extreme it is. This is a downer. This is not a horror movie you put on to have like a fun time.
No, it's kind of Lars von Trier-ish in how it's gloomy and kind of cerebral at the same time.
I think a little bit less of a provocation than von Trier. I've heard people compare it to Antichrist, and I think there are a couple of stylistic similarities.
Well, the directors zoom over some trees. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, there's also an ominous canine in the woods as
for
well.
Sure.
So that's it. Does not at any point say chaos reigns or say anything really.
Boo. But, the best talking fox this year was not in a horror film. It was in The Green Knight.
That's true. Yeah. Another film I think actually influenced by Antichrist in some respects.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, I was quite. I found Violation quite intriguing. It's a play on, for those who don't know, it's a play on the rape revenge genre, which is a genre that sort of came up largely in the 1970s and was known for extremely graphic depictions of both rape and sexual assault and of the violence that is incurred by those actions.
Yeah, there's been a lot of academic writing about this particular subgenre, and I think it's a really pure distillation of sort of the relationship between politics and exploitation filmmaking. It's very on the surface in these movies.
Very much so. Violation struck me as a really interesting subversion of a lot of what those movies are generally doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the way that the film handles sexual assault, for one thing, is I think in a pretty smart way, in that the movie finds a way to the movie can't not depict it,
right?
Because it's so crucial to what happens in this film.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie abstracts it in a way that basically denies any possibility of titillation.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
It is this foreign, hostile, awful thing that happens, and the movie is not because you'll see movies that where something like Irreversible, where Gaspar Noé's film, that movie is definitely, you know, you're not meant to enjoy the rape scene in that.
No, but
it's explicit in a way that there are those who might enjoy it, honestly.
Yeah, my personal opinion on that is like some people need that thrown in their face to have the reality of the situation highlighted, and some people don't.
Yeah.
And the people that don't, sometimes that's because they've experienced it in real life.
Yeah.
And they don't need a movie to tell them that.
You don't need that triggering imagery necessarily.
But some people do, you know, because some people don't have a real conception of how damaging something like that is.
Totally.
Yeah.
I think violation is smart in depicting the act, but also abstracting it in a way so we understand how awful it is, but it's not something that – something so grueling that the audience is forced to go into it. It's not a 10-minute fucking extended scene. But at the same time, the film then denies what rape revenge films so often do.
Catharsis. Yeah. I thought it was really interesting the way that film complicated catharsis. And it's a point that's made in some films about revenge, like Shan-Wook Park's movies always kind of come to the conclusion that revenge is ultimately pointless. Mm-hmm. And this film, I think it's the same. It's making a similar type of point where it's saying that, like, this isn't going to fix anything. This isn't going to save you. This is only going to make things worse.
I actually I think there's some curious threads to pull on with this film in terms of as a character study. And I think partially what it might be doing is saying that the act of revenge in this film is less about the perpetrator and more about, in some twisted way, trying to mend the relationship between our main character and another character.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think it's because the movie is at least partially about what happens when this happens to you. And the people in your life, the people who are supposed to love you, don't believe you.
Don't listen to you, yeah.
And it's like, what would it take in an abstract horror movie kind of way? Mm-hmm. What would it take to forgive that person and to be able to mend that relationship?
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's something really tricky going on with where this film goes in that respect.
Interesting.
I was fascinated by it. I had heard that the violence was really extreme. In some ways, I was surprised that it was not that graphic. I mean, there's some graphic.
It's just like what happens is so disgusting.
Yeah.
And so extreme that maybe like my imagination filled in the details, but I literally had a bad dream about this movie.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I will say it also takes all the joy out of seeing out of seeing an abuser get what's coming to them.
But like
so to
you were
speak.
Saying, I think that's the point.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting film. I think you could make the case that it's not actually a horror movie, that it's a drama that has elements of horror. But in terms of if I look at this year in horror, this is the one that I think I found the most thought-provoking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a really interesting prickly character study in a lot of ways too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, and if you have seen a few of these type of movies, you know, a good number of women that I know are fascinated by this subgenre.
Sure.
And I think that if you're fascinated by the idea of it, like if you've never seen one before and it doesn't appeal to you, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. But like,
or maybe don't jump into the don't start the with end. I spit on your grave or
right.
something.
Right.
You know?
See the movie Revenge that's also on Shudder, the French one from a few years ago. I think that's the closest to an entry level rape revenge movie as you're gonna get.
Work but, your way in for sure.
Yeah, yeah. This one's definitely like an Olympic level thing, but yeah. Like I thought that philosophically the questions that it asks about our assumptions about the function of the genre were super interesting.
Definitely. Okay, so let's talk about Violation. We both really liked.
Mm-hmm.
How about we end by talking about the film, giving another horror movie that you would recommend this year that you would say is one of the best you've seen this year?
Yeah. And mine is, Violation's on Shudder if you are interested in seeing that. The other one that I'm going to recommend is also on Shudder. It just came out a couple weeks ago and I was excited to check it out and I checked it out over the weekend and I really liked this movie. It was called The Medium. It is by a Thai director who he made, if you remember a movie called Shutter, an S-H-U-T-T-E-R, not D-D-E-R. it came out back in 2004. It was a Tartan Asia Extreme title back in the day.
Kind of J-horror-ish, right?
No, it was from Thailand.
Well, but like the general vibe of it is sort of J-horror-ish, right?
Yeah, it was part of that Asian horror style of that era.
Ghosts and shit?
Yeah, ghosts and shit, okay. Ghosts and shit, long-haired girls, you know, white contact lenses, that sort of thing.
Sure.
For sure. So the director of that film, please forgive me if you're Thai. I'm so sorry. His name is Bongjong Pisathanakum, and he's become a pretty famous director in Thailand. He made some big box office hits over there. And this new movie, what's another interesting thing about this movie is it's produced by the director of another really interesting possession movie called The Wailing, who's a Korean director named Na Hong Jin. So this movie was very interesting to me. It's 2 hours long. My only complaint about it is that it's long. But it's the first hour is a lot like The Exorcist in that it's naturalistic. And what it is it's the slow accumulation of symptoms and elimination of possibilities until the characters, like in The Exorcist, are forced to accept that there is no natural explanation for what is going on.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it's done in a found footage style, but it is one of the more thoughtful found footage movies that I've ever seen, in that the premise is that they're making a documentary. And so that justifies how, you know, the shots are well done.
Right.
You know, it's well shot because it's supposed to be a professional documentary crew making a documentary about shamans in rural Thailand and kind of Thai folk beliefs. And it revolves around this family where I guess shamanism can be an inherited thing in Thailand, to where like your grandmother was a shaman, so you become a shaman.
Got
type
it.
Of thing.
Like a dynasty.
Yeah. And in the premise of this family was that their mother was a shaman. There's these two sisters, and the one sister is chosen to become a shaman, but she rejects it. She says no and becomes a Christian instead. And then, but so her sister takes on the family business, basically, of being a shaman. Mm. And then many years later, the sister who rejected shamanism, her husband dies, and her daughter starts exhibiting symptoms of being possessed. Oh. And so all that background kind of starts coming in about like, oh, well, did you curse the family by rejecting this gift of shamanism? Mm. And it's a really it's an interesting combination of The Exorcist, some Thai folk horror kind of beliefs, you know, where they kind of delve into some of the beliefs in the region about spirits and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And also what's interesting is it turns into Paranormal Activity for a little while in the middle.
Did it scare you?
Yeah, it creeped me out, man. This movie creeped me out. So the first hour is kind of like The Exorcist, and then there's a Paranormal Activity bit in the middle where they kind of install the camera crew, the premises, they install cameras in the family's house, and then you see all the creepy stuff the possessed girl is doing in there.
Got it.
If you like dogs, forewarning.
So this one needs to be added to Did the Dog Die?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
And then the last half an hour of it is just like a crazy intense funhouse carnival ride.
Oh, cool.
Like it starts off slow burn and then it kind of, you know, gets a little bit more visceral in the middle. And then it's like 40 minutes of just like pummeling, like, you know, running through the woods, things jumping out at you, screaming intensity for like an extended period of that. And then it's got one little thoughtful coda at the end. And after all that, you know, you go through like the bumpy ride of all the really intense stuff. But it was the like last 2 minutes of the movie that like creeped me out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
right there at the end.
Yeah. The Medium. Uh-huh. It's on Shudder.
Okay.
I recommend it.
So new film from the director of Shudder is available on Shudder.
Yeah. TTER on DDER.
Cool. Okay, so Beyond Violation, which I do think people should check out if they're ready for that. Mm-hmm. Violation, not a very fun movie.
Yeah. I mean, if you watch Lars von Trier movies, you can handle it.
Definitely, definitely. But if you want to see one that is fun, my recommendation for the year would be James Wan's Malignant.
Yeah, I liked Malignant too.
It's a lot of fun. I think what's tricky about Malignant in some ways is that it's a film that I think almost by necessity needs to be kind of boring and generic for its first half.
Yeah. Oh, well, okay, so the first half of Malignant, I was like, you know, when we were talking about the OOs coming back, I was like, oh my God, James Wan's going back to his roots, because James Wan came up in the early 2000s.
He did.
And he's very much going back to that, like, Dead Silence, is that his first movie with the puppet?
After Saw.
Yeah. It reminded me of that movie quite a bit.
Yeah, at first it's sort of, there's a series of slayings in, I think they're in Seattle, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
There's a series of slayings, and this woman, played by Annabelle Wallace, is getting visions of them, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, the movie just seems like pure supernatural horror boilerplate, mm-hmm. I think, in a lot of ways. Well directed, because I think Juan at this point is very, very talented at this style of horror. I think he has this kind of supercharged funhouse style, mm-hmm. where the camera is almost this spring-loaded thing that he's running around. And so I enjoyed it in a kind of abstract way for a while also acknowledging that, like, Juan, this is pretty boilerplate for you.
Yeah.
You know, Juan has obviously gone on over the years. He made the first Insidious film. He made the first two Conjuring movies. He's become mm-hmm. kind of a leader in the industry in terms of mainstream horror.
Absolutely.
Malignant did not seem like one of his best for a while, but this movie takes a turn later on.
Yeah.
That sort of plummets it into a whole far more lunatic space.
Oh my God, dude! The first half of this movie, I was like, what?
Yeah.
And then the second half, I was like, what?
Yeah. So it's really a payoff. And I do honestly think that part of the reason that the second half works so well is that the first half lulls you with its mediocrity in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be one kind of movie, and then it becomes a way nuttier one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that works because the audience is used to the kind of boilerplate tropes that the first half is giving you by the spoonful.
Yeah, absolutely. And the second half, you know, James Wan can do pastiche sometimes, you know, like mm-hmm. in The Conjuring, he's doing 70s style horror. This one, I felt like he was doing like specifically trashy early 80s Italian horror movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's definitely
not Giallo. Giallo is something else.
Yeah. Well, there's a little bit of that in it too, though, with these kind of generic detectives investigating the killings,
yeah.
You know. And in any case, it's a lot of fun. And it's a movie that I would say, if you start watching it and you think you've seen this movie before, stick with it.
Yes.
It you're good. I think you're going to be, especially if you're a horror fan and you're a fan of some outrageous gore, I think you're going to be very satisfied with where this movie goes and glad that you put the time into it.
It's a very, like, you know, standing on, jumping on the seat, screaming type of ending to this movie. We're just like, what is happening? It's wild.
It's one of the only things, one of the only horror movies I saw this year that I felt like genuinely surprised me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same. That's all we've got for you this week. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to Film Club wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Film Club was hosted by me, Alex Dowd, and by Katie Reif. It was produced by Carl Blomberg. Our editor and mixer is Zach Goldsboro, and our motion graphics designer is Julie Bowens. Tune in next week when we kick off our one-month retrospective on the films of Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yay.
Thanks, all.
Bye. I am stoked for PTA month.
Yeah. Like, watching great movies all month? Like, hell yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.